This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Well, now, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed for crimes neither of them committed 62 years ago. And the impact of the government's conduct in the Rosenberg trial still affects us today. Virtually all the criticism of the lack of respect for defendants' rights in our present conduct of loyalty and national security trials can be traced to the forced absence of the Constitution at the 1951 trial. Continued research into the Rosenberg trial and dissemination of the documented perjuries and prosecutorial and judicial deceptions contributes to today's efforts to reintroduce constitutional trials into every courtroom, regardless of the politics of religion or color of the defendant.
And that is why now, on the centennial of Ethel Rosenberg's birth date, that Building Bridges continues to raise these issues and believe that we must win an official review of the Rosenberg's case and subsequently their exoneration.
Although nothing can change the finality of the death penalty,
an acknowledgement of government wrongdoing in this historic cause would be a first step in halting the perversions of due process and human rights that continue to undermine the legal system and this country's proclamation of democracy.
Robbie Rosenberg begins his presentation by discussing the song Strange Fruit, an anti-lynching song written by Abel Maripol, who adopted him after the execution of his parents. Abel Maripol wrote Strange Fruit under the name Lewis Allen, and it was popularized by the great singer Billie Holiday. Robbie draws some creative and fascinating parallels between his birth mother and the life and death of Billie Holiday, both women born 100 years ago. Now, on the 62nd anniversary of the execution of the Rosenbergs, Robert Maripol, son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and Sophia Elijah, executive director of the Correctional Association, speak on legal and extra-legal lynchings, America's strange fruit.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Strange fruit is not a lament, it's an attack. Abel meant it as an attack. He is attacking the people who are committing lynching. He is degrading them. He is exposing them, and that's why the song caused such a furor, because it shamed people. And that's what I think is really the power of the song. It just, the film moved me. I think it's amazing. It's almost prescient. That film was made in 2002, and it could have been made yesterday. Tomorrow evening will mark the 62nd anniversary of my parents, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg's execution. But clearly from this film, it's not just about what happened 62 years ago. It's about today. And it's fitting, because my parents would have wanted us to talk about what was happening today. They wrote in their last letter that they died comforted by the knowledge that others would carry on after them. We have, we are, and we will continue to carry on and justify that trust. Now, this year, April marked what would have been Billie Holiday's 100th birthday. She's famous for a lot of things, but perhaps now she's most famous for singing Strange Fruit. And you heard the words in the documentary, but I think they're worth repeating, so I'll recite them for you. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, and the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for a tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop. But what's Billie Holiday's centenary and strange fruit have to do with the 62nd anniversary of my parents' execution? As you know, my adoptive father, Abel Mirapol, wrote the words and music to Strange Fruit, and that Abel was a high school English teacher with a passion for writing who reacted to a gruesome photograph of a lynching in late 1936. In 1937 or 1938, he set the poem to music and changed the title. Billie Holiday did not perform it until 39. Strange Fruit was the composition that my father was most proud of, but it's not one that he ever lived easily with. As you saw, in 1940, he was called before the Rapp-Kuder Committee, the legislative commission that was studying communists in the schools in New York. You know, they talk about commissioned. He was asked if the Communist Party ordered him to write the song. Abel thought that was rather amusing. And then later, Billie Holiday claimed she had written it, and to this day you can find online references to Strange Fruit that attribute the words to Abel Mirapol and the music to Billie Holiday. And I witnessed growing up in the Mirapol household his frustration at being unable to correct this misrepresentation. But Abel was even more troubled by the song's eclipse. It was widely recognized in the 1940s, but in the Great Red Scare of the 1950s, it almost disappeared from the public arena. In fact, by the time Abel died in 1986, the song had faded into relative obscurity. That was one of Abel's biggest regrets. But that strange fruit illusion, lynched bodies hanging from trees, was one of genius. It had gotten under our culture's skin. And as time went on, it began to seep out of its pores. The song's rebirth was slow at first, recorded out of the country or at the edges of acceptability. The British Jamaican group UB40, Sting performed it on an album celebrating Amnesty International's 25th anniversary in 1986. And the punk group Susie and the Banshees followed suit in 87. Cassandra Wilson introduced Strange Fruit to a new generation in her widely heralded debut album in 1995. And in 2000, Time magazine, of all places, named it the song of the century. David Margolick's book, Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday, Cafe Society, and An Early Cry for Civil Rights, sold well. And this is followed in 2002 by the documentary. So the impact of the song was gathering momentum, but 2013 saw the Strange Fruit concept explode. Kanye West's sampling of Nina Simone's version in his Yeezus CD made an internet sensation. West's whiny rap, complaining about not being able to sit in the same VIP section as his ex-girlfriend at a sporting event, featured Nina Simone's line in the background, repeated over and over again, her cover of Strange Fruit. You hear in the background, blood on the leaves, blood on the leaves, blood on the leaves, while he's whining about not being able to sit in them. Abel Mirapol would have turned over in his grave, but the song exploded into public consciousness. Since then, I hear regularly about new recordings, concert performances, musicals, dances, even art exhibits inspired by the song. In November 2013, an episode of the TV series Criminal Minds, which ironically features heroic FBI agents, was about a lynching and was entitled Strange Fruit. which was played during it. It has even been used as a verb. To strange fruit someone is what George Zimmerman did to Trayvon Martin. 2014 saw Audra McDonald win Grammys for singing it on Broadway, and her performance was broadcast just this April repeatedly by HBO. Annie Lennox covered it last fall in her latest album, and there is so much more. Almost 80 years after Abel wrote those 93 potent words, that's right, the entire song is less than 100 words, the pot is in full boil. The Black Lives Matter movement and Strange Fruit are so entwined it is difficult to read about one without hearing a reference to the other. Today, Strange Fruit reverberates from Ferguson to Staten Island to Los Angeles and everywhere in between. But what's that got to do with the Rosenberg case? If Ethel Rosenberg were alive, just like Billie Holiday, she'd celebrate her 100th birthday this year. At first glance, they seem like an unlikely couple. But a closer look reveals surprising parallels. Each were born into poverty, 6 months and 100 miles apart. Billie in April 1915 in Philadelphia, and Ethel in September, the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Both had extraordinary singing voices, although Billie's vocal genius eclipsed Ethel's. Still, Ethel's teacher considered her voice so special that they called her out of class to sing the national anthem at assemblies at Seward Park High School. Both girls were precocious. Ethel graduated high school at the age of 15 and tried to pursue a singing and acting career. At the height of the Depression, she could only find work as a clerk typist in New York's garment district. There, she helped organize and lead a strike at the age of 19. Billie was singing in clubs in Harlem at 17 and made her mark as a recording artist before she reached the age of 20. Both got into trouble with the law. Billie first ran afoul of powerful forces for singing Strange Fruit. Her performances generated threats, even riots. As you know, Josh White also sang the song, was questioned by the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy period, and bowed to their demands and stopped singing it. Billie defiantly refused and continued singing Strange Fruit. Many believe that her resistance led law enforcement to hound and arrest her in 1947 for drug possession. She served almost a year in prison, and her conviction disrupted her career for the rest of her life. In 1950, Ethel was arrested with her husband Julius and charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. The government knew she had not committed espionage, but they held her as a hostage to coerce her husband into cooperating with the authorities. She refused to confess to something she did not do and backed her husband's refusal to implicate others. The FBI files never claimed she was guilty, but consistently described her as cognizant and recalcitrant. I like that line, cognizant and recalcitrant. You might conclude that both Billie and Ethel were cognizant and recalcitrant. They had similar talents and defied similar enemies. Both died prematurely, victimized by law enforcement. Ethel was executed along with her husband in 1953 at age 37. Billie died handcuffed to a hospital bed at age 44 while awaiting arraignment after another drug arrest. Billie and Ethel followed different paths in life and probably never met, but they converged in death. As you know from the film, high school English teacher, poet, and songwriter Abel Mirapol wrote Strange Fruit after seeing a photograph of a lynching. He played it for Billie in 1939 when she was performing at Cafe Society in Greenwich Village. 14 years later, Abel helped carry Ethel Rosenberg's coffin to her gravesite. Within a year, Abel and Anne had adopted Ethel and Julius's sons. Abel, the man who abhorred lynching, adopted Ethel's orphans, my brother and me. We remember Billie Holiday for singing about lynching, and we remember Ethel Rosenberg for being legally lynched. The lessons I take from this, and I believe Ethel and Julius would draw them as well, is that our court system can act as an agent of racism and repression, either by persecuting or prosecuting racial and political minorities, or by deciding which crimes, like lynching, to ignore. While I'm pleased this year to see Billy honored and Abel receive the recognition he so richly deserves, it is bittersweet that it comes decades after they both have died. And of course, on the eve of the 62nd anniversary of my mother's execution, I note that as her 100th birthday approaches, it is past time for Ethel to receive the vindication and honors she deserves as well. Thank you.
And now we'll have Sophia Elijah, who's the executive director of the Correctional Association of New York, entitled Political Repression, Extrajudicial and Legal Lynching.
The Correctional Association is an independent, not-for-profit organization that was actually founded in 1844, and it has the legislative authority to monitor the conditions in the prisons and jails throughout New York State. It's been doing that for 170 years. We are based in Harlem, and we travel all over the state monitoring those conditions and advocating for change in the criminal justice and youth justice systems. I'm the first woman and first person of color to ever head the organization. So, Robbie actually gave me a great segue into what I want to talk with you about. I first learned about Ethel and Julius Rosenberg from my parents, who were working class people who raised their three daughters out on Long Island. But my dad was someone who used to go and listen to the McCarthy trials in Foley Square as a young man. He abhorred the racism that he found when he went into the military. And when my parents moved out to Hempstead, Long Island, they were greeted with a sign that was written on the fence that bordered our backyard that said, "Go home, niggers." And they played Strange Fruit for us on a regular basis. I don't know what they thought those three little girls were supposed to understand from Strange Fruit, but I very much had the song embedded in my brain long before I understood what it actually meant and understood the story of the Rosenbergs. The reason that I think is very relevant, the song and the story and the what happened, the horror that happened to the Rosenberg family, is how much it is replicated by the horror that so many families experience today. As Robbie mentioned, we still have Strange Fruit. It's not necessarily created by people wearing white uniforms. Now they're wearing blue uniforms. Okay? And they're not doing their dastardly deeds by the cover of night, but more in the middle of the day. And they are being given a pass by our so-called justice system, from San Francisco to Ferguson to Texas, and I fear Charleston, South Carolina. There's no place that people look like me can be safe in this country, not even in our places of worship. And as horrific as that is, and indeed it is horrific, tonight I want to focus on yet more strange fruit. And that is the strange fruit in our prisons across this country. Millions of people are being subjected to terror every day. They're being emotionally abused, medically neglected, maimed, brutalized, and murdered by people who are paid by our tax dollars to keep us supposedly safe. I've been focusing on what happens in prisons for a long time, from right around the time that I was 17. And those of you who are kind in the audience will say, "Oh, that's just for 3 years." My high school childhood boyfriend went to prison as I went off to college, and he was incarcerated at Auburn Prison. And so my first prison visit, at 17 years old, I didn't dare tell my parents that I was going to see him. And the first thing that struck me was that everybody in the visiting room looked like me. And everybody who was wearing uniforms who were guards didn't look like me. And I watched my boyfriend, who was a brilliant young man, whose two older siblings had both overdosed due to heroin addiction, and he also had fallen victim of heroin addiction. I watched his brilliance crumble inside Auburn State Prison. And what was happening to him has been happening to millions of black and brown, mostly young men, but also women, in this country with impunity. But what also is happening is this concept of violence and brutality that's happening inside. So in Attica State Prison, there's lawlessness on steroids going on. How many of you saw the story a few months ago in the New York Times front page of the Sunday edition that lasted for 3 full pages that talked about the horror of the beating that was visited upon a young man who was 29 years old named George Williams? How many people saw that? Okay. George Williams, in August of 2011, with 4 months left before he was to be released from prison, and he had been sent to prison for robbing a couple of jewelry stores in which nobody was injured. George Williams was taken out of his cell by 4 guards. Both of his legs were broken, his left shoulder blade, his left eye socket, several ribs, his lung was punctured, and he had multiple lacerations and bruises all over his body. The guards who did this to him took him to solitary confinement, where they had decided, you know, judge and jury, that he should be given a sentence of solitary confinement for assaulting them. When they took him to the solitary confinement unit of the prison, the guard who was responsible for that unit refused to admit him into solitary confinement, only because he did not want to be charged with the responsibility of the injuries that George had. And so, no, you have to take him to the infirmary. So the guards begrudgingly dragged him to the infirmary. I forgot to mention that they threw him down several flights of stairs where he was shackled and handcuffed, so he couldn't even defend himself. They took him to the infirmary, where a nurse who had been hired not too long before said, oh, no, you can't bring him to the infirmary because he's too badly injured. We have to call 911. And before the guards could stop her, she dialed 911, and an ambulance came, and the guards flew into a rage and proceeded to berate and curse her out. The ambulance took George to the hospital, and that is the only reason that we in the public know anything about what happened. And for the first time in the history of New York State, guards were indicted for brutalizing a person who was incarcerated. So think about this. It was in 2012, the first time in the history of New York State, that there was any prosecution of guards for brutalizing people who are incarcerated. Now, I can tell you, I'm a criminal defense attorney by training, and I, over the course of my career, have learned of countless people who were brutalized by guards while they were incarcerated. It was historic in that there was a prosecution that was brought. But what was also historic was after 4 years, those guards were allowed to plead guilty to official misconduct, minimal misdemeanors, resign from their jobs, and keep their pension, while George Williams is maimed for life. George Williams walks with a cane, with effort, now, at 32 years old. And he will never have his regular gait restored. And when those guards were indicted, the guards union, known as NYSCOBA, the same guards union that files protest after protest when various political prisoners here held in New York State come up for parole, that guards union authorized a protest, and so the flag was lowered to half mast and the guards staged a work slowdown. So no visitors were allowed into Attica, no programmatic staff were allowed into Attica, people were not taken for their meals, and everything came to a virtual halt. And this went on for days, despite the DOCS commissioner ordering them to go back to work in the normal style. So they function like a gang. Business as usual, this has continued. So back in April of this year, less than 10 days apart, a man who was incarcerated in Sullivan Prison and another man who was incarcerated at the Fishkill facility, both of whom have mental health issues, were beaten to death by guards. Beaten to death. And those guards were overheard in both facilities by other people who were incarcerated putting together their story about how they were going to claim that they had been assaulted by these men and that they only acted to defend themselves from vicious assaults by these men. And this is the norm. So why do I bring this to you? Because this is the 2015 strange fruit. And we have to speak out. Okay? Everybody that you know, you should sound like you have a tape recorder and just tell everybody that you know what you heard tonight. Okay? And call upon our elected officials to say, this must stop. There should not be anybody allowed to wear a uniform, whether or not they're patrolling the streets or they're patrolling a prison, who has that job without being reviewed by a civilian committee that says you are fit to actually maintain public safety. Because in black and brown communities, those people are responsible for domestic terror. My sons can't go any place in this city feeling safe, despite the fact that they have a mother who's a lawyer, who's taught at Harvard Law School, who runs a respected not-for-profit organization. They can't go anyplace feeling safe. There's something fundamentally wrong where the color of your skin determines the activities of your day. As we reflect on what Ethel and Julia stood for, let's give meaning to their legacy by making sure that our silence does not allow our children and our grandchildren to still be talking about the strange fruit of their day.
And you were listening to Sophia Jill Elijah with the Correctional Association. And before that, Robbie Mirpool, the youngest son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, executed 62 years ago. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.